the picket lines and the fort with water that fell as though dumped from a bottomless bucket. Sometimes they only drifted past, grumbling and ominous. Tonight the clouds were low and fierce, veined with lightning and blanketing the sky. Heat lightning throbbed through their bodies and crackled between them in bursts of sudden, silent conversation. And now and then a sudden fork shot blue-white and vivid to the ground with a crack of thunder that made everyone jump. There was very little to pack, just as well as there was very little time in which to pack it. I could hear the flurry all through the barracks as I worked, people calling out in search of lost objects, mothers bellowing for lost children, and the shuffle and thunder of feet, steady as echoing rain in the wooden stairwells. Outside, I could hear the agitated baaing of a number of sheep, disturbed at being turned out of their pens, and a sudden racket of shouting and mooing as a panicked cow made a break for it. Not surprising, there was a strong smell of fresh blood in the air from the slaughtering. I had seen the garrison on parade, of course. I knew how many men there were, but to see 3,000 or 4,000 people pushing and shoving, trying to accomplish unaccustomed tasks in a tearing hurry, was like watching a kicked-over anthill. I made my own way through the seething mass, clutching a flour sack with spare clothes, my few medical supplies, and a large chunk of ham I had acquired from a grateful patient, wrapped in my extra petticoat. I would evacuate with the boat brigade, minding a group of invalids. But I didn't mean to go without seeing Jamie. My heart had been in my mouth for so long that I could barely speak. Not for the first time, I thought how convenient it was to have married a very tall man. It was always easy to pick Jamie out of a crowd, and I saw him within moments, standing on one of the demi-lune batteries. Some of his militiamen were with him, all looking downward. I assumed that the boat brigade must be forming below. That was heartening. The prospect, once I reached the edge of the battery and could see, was considerably less heartening. The lake shore below the fort looked like the return of a particularly disastrous fishing fleet. There were boats, all kinds of boats, from canoes and rowboats to dories and crude rafts. Some were dragged up onto the shore. Others were evidently floating away, unmanned. I caught sight, during a brief lightning flash, of a few heads bobbing in the water as men and boys swam after them to fetch them back. There were few lights on the shore, for fear of giving away the plan of retreat, but here and there a torch burned, showing arguments and fistfights, and beyond the reach of torchlight, the ground seemed to heave and ripple in the dark like a swarming carcass. Jamie was shaking hands with Mr. Anderson, one of the Teal's original hands, who had become his de facto corporal. "Go with God," he said. Mr. Anderson nodded and turned away, leading the small knot of militiamen. They passed me as I came up, and one or two nodded to me, their faces invisible in the shadow of their hats. "Where are they going?" I asked Jamie.
"Toward Hubberton," he replied, his eyes still on the lake shore below. "I told them it was their own choice, but I thought best they went sooner rather than later."
He lifted his chin toward the humped black shape of Mount Defiance, where the sparks of campfires glow near the summit.
"If they dinna ken what's happening, it's gross incompetence. Were I Simon Fraser, I should be on the march before first light."
"You don't mean to go with your men?" A spark of hope sprang up in my heart. There was little light on the battery, only the reflected glow from the torches on the stairs and the bigger fires inside the fort. This was enough for me to see his face clearly, though, when he turned to look at me. It was sombre, but there was an eagerness in the set of his mouth, and I recognised the look of a soldier ready to surge into action.
"No," he said, "I mean to go with you."
He smiled suddenly, and I gripped his hand.
"You dinna think I mean to leave you to wander in the wilderness with a parcel of diseased half-wits? Even if it does mean getting into a boot," he added with a touch of distaste.
I laughed, despite myself. "Not very kind," I said, "but not inaccurate either. If you mean Mrs. Raven." You haven't seen her anywhere, have you? He shook his head. The wind had pulled half his hair loose from its thong, and he removed this now and placed it between his teeth, gathering up his hair in a heavy tail to rebind it. Someone down the battery said something, sounding startled, and both Jamie and I jerked round to look. Mount Independence was on fire. Fire! Fire! The screams brought people, already flustered and upset, rushing out of the barracks like coveys of flushed quail. The fire was just beneath the summit of Mount Independence, where General Fermoy had established an outpost with his men. A tongue of flame soared upward, steady as a candle taking breath. Then a gust of wind flattened it, and the flame squatted for a moment, as though someone had turned down the gas on a stove, before bursting out again in a much wider conflagration that lit up the mount, showing the tiny black shapes of what looked like hundreds of people in the act of striking tents and loading baggage, all silhouetted against the fire.
"It's Fermoy's quarters on fire," a soldier said beside me, disbelieving. "Isn't it?"
"It is," said Jamie on my other side, sounding grim. "And if we can see the retreat starting from here, Burgoyne's lookouts must surely see it too."
And, as simply as that, the rout began. Had I ever doubted the existence of something like telepathy, this would have been enough to quell any reservations. The soldiers were already at breaking point from St. Clair's delay and the constant drum of rumours beating on stretched nerves. As the fire on Mount Independence spread, the conviction that the Redcoats and the Indians would be upon us at once spread from mind to mind without the necessity for speech. Panic was loose, spreading its broad black wings over the fort, and the confusion at the water's edge was disintegrating into chaos before our eyes.
"Come then," Jamie said,
and before I knew it, I was being hustled down the narrow steps of the battery. A few wooden huts had been set on fire, these on purpose, to deprive the invaders of useful material, and the light from the flames lit up a scene from hell. Women dragging half-dressed children, screaming and trailing bedclothes, men throwing furniture from windows. A thunder mug crashed on the stones, sending shards of sharp pottery slicing across the legs of the people nearby. A voice came breathless behind me.
"A golden guinea says a silly French bugger set the house on fire himself."
"I'll gi' ye nae odds on that one," Jamie replied briefly. "I only hope he went up with it."
A tremendous flash of lightning lit up the fort like day, and screams rose from every part of it, only to be drowned almost instantly by the explosion of thunder. Predictably, half the people thought the wrath of God was about to be visited upon us. This, in spite of the fact that we had been having thunderstorms of similar ferocity for days, I thought crossly. While those of secular minds were still more panicked because the militia units on the outer lines were being lit up as they withdrew, in full sight of the British on Mount Defiance. Either way, it didn't help matters.
"I have to fetch my invalids," I shouted into Jamie's ear. "You go and get the things from the barracks."
He shook his head. His flying loose hair was lit up by another lightning flash, and he looked like one of the principal demons himself.
"I'm no leaving you," he said, taking a firm clasp of my arm. "I might never find you again."
"But..." My objection died as I looked. He was right. There were thousands of people running, pushing, or simply standing in place, too stunned to think what to do. If we were separated, he might not find me. And the thought of being alone in the woods below the fort, these infested with bloodthirsty Indians as well as redcoats, was not something I wanted to contemplate for more than 10 seconds.
"Right," I said. "Come on, then."
The scene inside the hospital barracks was less frantic, only because most of the patients were less capable of movement. They were, if anything, more agitated than the people outside, as they'd gleaned only the most fragmentary intelligence from people rushing in and out. Those with families were being dragged bodily from the building with barely enough time to seize their clothes. Those without were in the spaces between cots, hopping on one foot to get into their breeches or staggering toward the door.
Captain Stebbings, of course, was not doing any of these things. He lay placidly on his cot, hands folded on his chest, observing the chaos with interest, a rush dip burning placidly on the wall above him.
Mrs. Fraser!
He greeted me cheerfully.
I suppose I shall be a free man again shortly. Hope the army brings me some food. I think there's not much chance of supper here tonight.
I suppose you will, I said, unable not to smile back at him. You'll take care of the other British prisoners, will you? General St. Clair is leaving them behind. He looked mildly offended at this.
They're my men, he said.
So they are. In fact, Guinea Dick, almost invisible against the stone wall in the dim light, was crouching beside the captain's bed, a stout walking stick in his hand, in order to fend off would-be looters, I supposed. Mr. Ormiston was sitting up on his own cot, pale-faced but excited, picking at the binding on his stump.
They really coming, are they, ma'am? The army?
Yes, they are. Now, you must take good care of your wound and keep it clean. It's healing well, but you mustn't put any strain at all on it for another month at least. And wait at least 2 months before you have a peg fitted. Don't let the army surgeons bleed you. You need all your strength. He nodded, though I knew he'd be lining up for a fleam and a bleeding ball the moment a British surgeon showed up. He believed deeply in the virtues of being let blood, and had been slightly mollified only by my having leeched his stump now and then. I clasped his hand in farewell, and was turning to go when his own grip tightened.
A moment, ma'am.
He let go of my hand, fumbling at his neck, and withdrew something on a string. I could barely see it in the gloom, but he put it into my hand, and I felt a metal disc warm from his body.
If happen you might see that boy Abram again, ma'am, I should take it kind if you'd give him that. That's my lucky piece, what I've carried for 32 years. You tell him it will keep him safe in time of danger.
Jamie was looming up in the dark beside me, radiating impatience and agitation. He had a small group of invalids in tow, all clutching random possessions. I could hear Mrs. Raven's distinctive, high-pitched voice in the distance, wailing. I thought she was calling my name. I ducked my head and put Mr. Ormiston's lucky piece around my neck.
I'll tell him, Mr. Ormiston. Thank you.
Someone had set fire to Jedathan Baldwin's elegant bridge. A pile of rubbish smouldered near one end, and I saw black devil shapes running to and fro along the span with chisels and pry bars, ripping up the planks and throwing them into the water. Jamie shouldered a way through the mob, me behind him, and our little band of women, children, and invalids scurrying at my heels like goslings, honking in agitation.
Fraser! Colonel Fraser!
I turned at the shout to see Jonah, Bill I mean, Marsden, running down the shore.
I'll come with you, he said breathless. You'll need someone can steer a boat.
Jamie didn't hesitate for more than a fraction of a second. He nodded, jerking his head toward the shore.
Aye, run. I'll bring them along as fast as I can.
Mr. Marsden vanished into the dark.
The rest of your men?
I said, coughing from the smoke. He shrugged, a broad-shouldered silhouette against the black shimmer of the water.
Gone.
Hysterical screams came from the direction of the old French lines. These spread like wildfire through the woods and down the lakeshore. People shouting that the British were coming. Panic beating its wings. It was so strong a thing, that panic, that I felt a scream rise in my own throat. I throttled it and felt irrational anger in its place, displaced from myself to the fools behind me who were shrieking and would have scattered had they been able to. But we were close upon the shore now, and people were pressing toward the boats in such numbers that they were capsizing some of the craft as they piled in, higgledy-piggledy. I didn't think the British were at hand, but I didn't know. I knew that there had been more than one battle at Fort Ticonderoga, but when had they occurred? Was one of them going to be tonight? I didn't know, and the sense of urgency propelled me to the shore, helping to support Mr. Wellman, who had contracted the mumps from his son, poor man,
and was doing very badly in consequence. Mr. Marsden, bless him, had commandeered a large canoe, which he had paddled a little way out from shore to prevent its being overrun. When he saw Jamie approaching, he came in, and we succeeded in getting a total of 18 people, these including the Wellmans and Mrs. Raven, pale and staring as Ophelia, into it. Jamie glanced quickly back at the fort. The main gates hung wide, and firelight shone out of them. Then he glanced up at the battery where he and I had stood a little while before.
"There are 4 men by the cannon trained on the bridge," he said, his eyes still fixed on the red-bellied billows of smoke rising from the interior of the fort. "Volunteers. They'll stay behind. The British, or some of them, will certainly come across the bridge. They can destroy almost everyone on the boom and then flee, if they can."
He turned away then, and his shoulders bunched and flexed as he dug the paddle hard. Chapter 53. Mount Independence. Mid-afternoon, July the 6th. Brigadier Fraser's men advanced upon the picket fort at the top of the mount, the one the Americans ironically called Independence. William led one of the forward parties and had his men fix their bayonets as they drew close. There was a deep silence, broken only by the snap of branches and the shuffle of boots in the thick leaf mould, the stray clack of a cartridge box against musket butt. Was it a waiting silence, though? The Americans couldn't fail to know they were coming. Did the rebels lie in ambush, ready to fire upon them from the crude but very solid fortification he could see through the trees? He motioned to his men to stop some 200 yards short of the summit, hoping to pick up some indication of the defenders, if defenders there were. His own company halted obediently, but there were men behind, and they began to push into and through his own company, without regard, eager to storm the fort. "Halt!" he shouted, aware as he did so that the sound of his voice presented almost as good a target to an American rifleman as would the sight of his red coat. Some of the men did halt, but were at once dislodged by more behind them, and within seconds the whole of the hillside was a mass of red. They could not stop longer. They would be trampled. And if the defenders had meant to fire, they couldn't ask for a better opportunity. And yet, the fort stayed silent. "On!" William roared, throwing up his arm, and the men burst from the trees in a splendid charge, bayonets held ready. The gates hung ajar, and the men charged straight in, heedless of danger. But danger there was none. William came in with his men to find the place deserted. Not only abandoned, but evidently abandoned in an amazing hurry. The defenders' personal belongings were strewn everywhere, as though dropped in flight. Not only heavy things like cooking utensils, but clothes, shoes, books, blankets, even money, seemingly cast aside or dropped in panic. Much more to the point, so far as William was concerned, was the fact that the defenders had made no effort to blow up ammunition or powder that could not be carried away. There must be 200 weights stacked in kegs. Provisions, too, had been left behind, a welcome sight. "Why did they not set fire to the place?" Lieutenant Hammond asked him, looking goggle-eyed round at the barracks, still fully furnished with beds, bedding, chamber pots, ready for the conquerors to move straight into. "God knows," William replied briefly, then lunged forward as he saw a private soldier come out of one of the rooms, festooned in a lacy shawl, and with his arms full of shoes. "You there! We'll have no looting. None. Do you hear me, sir?" The private did, and dropping his armful of shoes, made off precipitately, lacy fringes flapping. A good many others were at it too, though, and it was clear to William that he and Hammond would be unable to stop it. He shouted above the increasing din for an ensign, and, seizing the man's dispatch box, scribbled a hasty note. "Take that to General Fraser," he said, thrusting it back at the ensign. "Fast as ever you can go." Dawn, July the 7th, 1777.
I will not have these horrid irregularities.
General Fraser's face was deeply creased, as much with rage as with fatigue. The small travelling clock in the general's tent showed just before 5 o'clock in the morning, and William had the oddly dreamy feeling that his head was floating somewhere over his left shoulder.
Looting, theft, rampant undiscipline, I will not have it, I say. Am I understood? All of you?
The small, tired group of officers gave assent in a chorus of grunts. They had been up all night chivying their troops into some sort of rough order, keeping back the rank and file from the worst excesses of looting, hurriedly surveying the abandoned outposts at the old French lines, and tallying the unexpected bounty of provisions and ammunition left for them by the fort's defenders, four of whom had been found when the fort was stormed, dead drunk, by the side of a primed cannon trained on the bridge below.
Those men, the ones who were taken, has anyone been able to talk with them as yet?
No, sir,
Captain Hayes said, stifling a yawn.
Still dead to the world. Very nearly dead for good, the surgeon said, though he thinks they'll survive. Shit themselves with fear, Hammond said softly to William, waiting all that time for us to come.
More likely boredom, William murmured back without moving his mouth.
Even so, he caught the brigadier's bloodshot eye and straightened up unconsciously.
Well, it's not as though we need them to tell us much.
General Fraser waved a hand to dispel a cloud of smoke that had drifted in and coughed. William inhaled gently. There was a succulent scent embodied in that smoke, and his stomach coiled in anticipation.
Ham? Sausage?
I've sent word back to General Burgoyne that Ticonderoga is ours, again, the brigadier added, breaking into a grin at the hoarse cheer from the officers. And to Colonel St. Leger. We shall leave a small garrison to take stock and tidy things up here. But the rest of us, well, there are rebels to be caught, gentlemen. I cannot offer you much respite, but certainly there is time for a hearty breakfast. Bon appétit.
Chapter 54. Return of the Native. Night, July the 7th. Ian Murray passed into the fort without difficulty. There were rangers and Indians aplenty, mostly lounging against the buildings, many of them drunk, others poking through the deserted barracks, occasionally chased away by harassed-looking soldiers set to guard the fort's unexpected bounty. There was no sign of slaughter, and he breathed easier. That had been his first fear. But while there was mess, and to spare, there was no blood and no smell of powder smoke. No shot had been fired here in the last day or so. He had a thought, and went toward the hospital barracks, largely ignored as it held nothing anyone would want. The smells of urine, shit, and old blood had decreased. Most of the patients must have gone with the retreating troops. There were a few people there, one in a green coat who, he thought, must be a surgeon, some plainly orderlies. As he watched, a pair of stretcher-bearers came out through the doors, boots scraping as they negotiated the shallow stone steps. He leaned back into the concealment of the doorway, for following the stretcher was the tall form of Guinea Dick, his face split in a cannibal's grin. Ian smiled himself, seeing it. Captain Stebbing still lived then, and Guinea Dick was a free man. And here, Jesus, Mary and Bride be thanked, came Mr. Ormiston behind him, stumping slowly on a pair of crutches, tenderly supported on either side by a pair of orderlies, the puny wee creatures dwarfed by the seaman's bulk. He could tell Auntie Claire then. She'd be pleased to hear they were all right. If he found Auntie Claire again. But he wasn't much worried, really. Uncle Jamie would see her safe come hell, wildfire, or the entire British army. When or where he'd see them again was another matter. But he and Rollo moved much faster than any army could. He'd catch up with them soon enough. He waited, curious to see whether there was anyone else left in the hospital. But either there was not, or they were to be left there for the nonce. Had the hunters gone with St. Clair's troops? In a way, he hoped they had, even knowing that they would likely fare better with the British than on the run down the Hudson Valley with the refugees from Ticonderoga. As Quakers, he thought, they would do well enough. The British probably wouldn't molest them. But he thought he would like to see Rachel Hunter again sometime, and his chance of that was much better if she and her brother had gone with the rebels. A little more poking about convinced him of two things, that the hunters had indeed gone, and that the leaving of Ticonderoga had been accomplished in the midst of panic and disorder. Someone had set fire to the bridge below, but it had only partially burned, perhaps put out by a rainstorm. There was a great deal of debris on the lake shore, suggesting a massive embarkation. Automatically he glanced toward the lake, where he could plainly see two large ships, both flying the Union flag. From his current perch on the battery, he could see redcoats swarming over both Mount Defiance and Mount Independence, and knew a small, surprising flare of resentment against them.
"Well, you'll not keep it long," he said under his breath.
He spoke in Gaelic, and a good thing too, for a passing soldier glanced casually at him, as though feeling the stress of his regard. He looked away himself, turning his back on the fort. There was nothing to do here, no one to wait for. He'd eat and pick up some provisions, then go fetch Rollo and be off. He could... A shattering whoom close at hand made him jerk round. To his right, one of the cannon was trained downward toward the bridge, and just behind it, open-mouthed with shock, was a Huron man swaying with drink. There was a lot of shouting from below. The troops thought they were being fired on from the fort, though the shot had gone high, splashing harmlessly into the lake. The Huron giggled.
"What did you do?"
Ian asked, in an Algonquian tongue he thought the man would most likely know. Whether he understood or not, the man simply laughed harder, tears beginning to run down his face. He gestured to a smoking tub nearby. Good Christ, the defenders had gone so fast they had left a tub of slow match burning.
Boom,
said the Huron, and gestured at a length of slow match, pulled from the tub, and left draped on the stones like a glowing snake.
Boom,
he said again, nodding at the cannon, and laughed until he had to sit down. Soldiers were running up to the battery, and the shouting from outside was equalled by that inside the fort. It was probably a good time to go. Chapter 55 Retreat.
We are pursuing the rebels, a great number of whom have taken to the lake in boats. The two sloops on the lake are following, but I am sending four companies down to the portage point, where I think the chance of capture is good. Brigadier General Simon Fraser to Major General J. Burgoyne.
July the 8th, 1777. William wished he hadn't accepted the brigadier's invitation to breakfast. If he had contented himself with the lean rations that were a lieutenant's lot, he would have been hungry but happy. As it was, he was on the spot, blissfully filled to the eyes with fried sausage, buttered toast, and grits with honey, for which the brigadier had developed a fondness, when the message had come from General Burgoyne. He didn't even know what it had said. The brigadier had read it while sipping coffee, frowning slightly, then sighed and called for ink and quill.
"Want a ride this morning, William?"
he'd asked, smiling across the table. Which is how he'd come to be at General Burgoyne's field headquarters when the Indians had come in. "Wyandot," one of the soldiers said. He wasn't familiar with them, though he had heard that they had a chief called Leatherlips, and he did wonder how had that come about. Perhaps the man was an indefatigable talker. There were five of them, lean, wolfish-looking rascals. He couldn't have said what they wore or how they were armed. All his attention was focused on the pole that one of them carried, this decorated with scalps. Fresh scalps. White scalps. A musky smell of blood hung in the air, unpleasantly ripe, and flies moved with the Indians, buzzing loudly. The remains of William's lavish breakfast coagulated in a hard ball just under his ribs. The Indians were looking for the paymaster. One of them was asking, in a surprisingly melodious English, where the paymaster was. So it was true, then. General Burgoyne had unleashed his Indians, sent them coursing through the woods like hunting dogs to fall upon the rebels and spread terror among them. He did not want to look at the scalps, but couldn't help it. His eyes followed them as the pole bobbed through a growing crowd of curious soldiers, some mildly horrified, some cheering. Jesus, was that a woman's scalp? It had to be. A flowing mass of honey-coloured hair, longer than any man would wear his hair, and shining as though its owner brushed it 100 strokes every night, like his cousin Dotty said she did. It wasn't unlike Dotty's hair, though a little darker. He turned away abruptly, hoping that he wouldn't be sick, but turned just as abruptly back when he heard the cry. He'd never heard a sound like that before. A shriek of horror, such grief, that his heart froze in his chest. Jane! Jane! A Welsh lieutenant he knew slightly, called David Jones, was forcing his way through the crowd, beating at the men with fists and elbows, lunging toward the surprised Indians, his face contorted with emotion.
Oh, God, breathed the soldier near him. His fiancée's called Jane. He can't mean...
Jones threw himself at the pole, snatching at the fall of honey-coloured hair, shrieking, Jane! At the top of his lungs. The Indians, looking disconcerted, jerked the pole away. Jones flung himself on one of them, knocking the surprised Indian to the ground and hammering him with the strength of insanity. Men were pushing forward, grabbing at Jones, but not doing so with any great heart. Appalled looks were being shot at the Indians, who clustered together, eyes narrowed and hands at their tomahawks. The whole sense of the gathering had changed in an instant from approval to outrage, and the Indians plainly sensed it. An officer William didn't know strode forward, daring the Indians with a hard eye, and tore the blonde scalp from the pole, then stood holding it, disconcerted, the mass of hair seeming alive in his hands, the long strands stirring, waving up around his fingers. They had finally pulled Jones off the Indian. His friends were patting his shoulders, trying to urge him away, but he stood stock still, tears rolling down his face and dripping from his chin. Jane, he mouthed silently. He held out his hands, cupped and begging, and the officer who held the scalp placed it gently into them. Chapter 56.
While Still Alive.
Lieutenant Stactoe was standing by one corpse, arrested. Very slowly he squatted down, his eyes fixed on something, and as though by reflex, covered his mouth with one hand. I really didn't want to look. He'd heard my footsteps, though, and took his hand away from his mouth. I could see the sweat trickling down his neck, the band of his shirt pasted to his skin, dark with it.
Do you suppose that was done while he was still alive? He asked in an ordinary tone of voice.
Reluctantly, I looked over his shoulder. Yes, I said, my voice as unemotional as his. It was.
Oh, he said.
He stood, contemplated the corpse for a moment, then walked away a few steps and threw up. Never mind, I said gently and took him by the sleeve. He's dead now. Come and help. Many of the boats had gone astray, been captured before they reached the end of the lake. Many more had been taken by British troops waiting at the portage point. Our canoe and several more had escaped, and we had made our way through the woods for a day and a night, and most of another day, before meeting with the main body of troops fleeing overland from the fort. I was beginning to think that those who were captured were the lucky ones. I didn't know how long it had been since the small group we had just discovered was attacked by Indians. The bodies were not fresh. Guards were posted at night. Those not on watch slept as though poleaxed, exhausted by a day of flight, if anything so cumbrous and laboured could be described by such a graceful word. I woke just past dawn from dreams of snow-white trees, gape-mouthed and grasping, to find Jamie crouched beside me, a hand on my arm.
"You'd best come, Ian," he said softly.
Mrs. Raven had cut her throat with a penknife. There wasn't time to dig a grave. I straightened her limbs and closed her eyes, and we piled rocks and branches over her before staggering back to the rut that passed for a road through the wilderness. As darkness came up through the trees, we began to hear them. High, ululating shrieks. Hunting wolves.
March on, Indians!"
one of the militiamen shouted. As if summoned by the shout, a blood-curdling shriek wavered through the darkness nearby, and the stumbling retreat turned at once to headlong panic, men dropping their bundles and pushing one another out of the way in their haste to flee. There were shrieks from the refugees, too, though these were quickly stifled.
"Off the road," Jamie said, low and fierce, and began pushing the slow and bewildered into the woods. "They may not know where we are yet."
And then again, they might.
"Do you have your death song ready, Uncle?"
Ian whispered. He had caught us up the day before, and now he and Jamie were pressed close on either side of me where we had taken cover behind a huge fallen trunk.
"Oh, I'll sing them a death song if it comes to that," Jamie muttered, half under his breath,
and took out one of the pistols from his belt. "You can't sing," I said. I hadn't meant to be funny. I was so frightened that I said it by reflex, the first thing that came into my mind. And he didn't laugh.
"That's true," he said. "Well, then."
He primed the pistol, closed the pan, and thrust it into his belt.
"Dinna be afraid, Ian," Jamie whispered,
and I saw his throat work as he swallowed.
"I'll not let them take you. Not alive."
He touched the pistol at his belt. I stared at him, then at the pistol. I hadn't thought it possible to be more afraid. I felt suddenly as though my spinal cord had snapped. My limbs wouldn't move and my bowels very literally turned to water. I understood in that moment exactly what had led Mrs. Raven to slash her own throat. Ian whispered something to Jamie and slid away, silent as a shadow. It occurred to me, belatedly, that by taking time to shoot me if we would be overrun, Jamie was very likely to fall alive into the hands of the Indians himself. And I was sufficiently terrorized that I couldn't tell him not to do it. I took hold of my courage with both hands and swallowed hard.
"Go," I said. They
probably won't harm women." My outer skirt hung in tatters, as did my jacket, and the whole ensemble was covered in mud, leaves, and the small bloody splotches of slow-moving mosquitoes. But I was still, identifiably, female.
"The devil I will,"
he said briefly.
"Uncle!"
Ian's voice came softly out of the darkness.
"It's not Indians."
"What?" I made no sense of this, but Jamie straightened abruptly.
"It's a redcoat, running alongside us, shrieking like an Indian, driving us."
Jamie swore under his breath. It was almost completely dark by now. I could see only a few vague shapes, presumably those of the people with us. I heard a whimper, almost underfoot, but when I looked, could see no one. The shrieks came again, now from the other side. If the man was driving us, did he know we were there? If so, where did he mean to drive us? I could feel Jamie's indecision. Which way? A second, perhaps two, and he took me by the arm, pulling me deeper into the woods. We ran slap into a large group of refugees within minutes. They had stopped dead, too terrified to move in any direction. They huddled together, the women clutching their children, hands clasped tight over the little ones' mouths, breathing, hush, like the wind.
Leave them, Jamie said in my ear, and tightened his grip on my arm.
I turned to go with him, and suddenly a hand seized my other arm. I screamed, and everyone near erupted in screams by sheer reflex. Suddenly the wood around us was alive with moving forms and shouts. The soldier, it was a British soldier, from so close I could see the buttons on his uniform and felt the thump of his cartridge box as it swung, striking me in the hip, leaned down to peer at me and grinned, his breath stale and scented with decay.
Stand still, love, he said. You're going nowhere now.
My heart was pounding so hard in my ears that it was a full minute before I realized that the grip on my other arm was gone. Jamie had vanished. We were marched back up the road in a tight group, moving slowly through the night. They let us drink at a stream at daylight, but kept us moving until the early afternoon, by which time even the most able-bodied were ready to drop. We were herded, none too gently, into a field. Farmer's wife that I was, I winced to see the stalks, only weeks away from harvest, being trampled underfoot, the fragile gold of the wheat cut and mangled into black mud. There was a cabin among the trees at the far end of the field. I saw a girl run out onto the porch, clap a hand to her mouth in horror, and disappear back inside. Three British officers came across the field, heading for the cabin, ignoring the seething mass of invalids, women, and children, all of whom were milling to and fro with no idea what to do next. I wiped the sweat out of my eyes with the end of my kerchief, tucked it back into my bodice, and looked around for anyone who might be nominally in charge. None of our own officers or able-bodied men seemed to have been captured. There had been only a couple of surgeons superintending the removal of the invalids, and I hadn't seen either one in 2 days. Neither one was here. All right, then, I thought grimly, and walked up to the nearest British soldier who was surveying the chaos through narrowed eyes, musket in hand. We need water, I said to him without preamble. There's a stream just beyond those trees. May I take 3 or 4 women to fetch back water for the sick and wounded? He was sweating, too. The faded red wool of his coat was black under the arms, and melted rice powder from his hair was rimed in the creases of his forehead. He grimaced, indicating that he didn't want to deal with me. But I simply stared at him as close as I could get. He glanced around in hopes of finding someone to send me to, but the three officers had disappeared into the cabin. He raised one shoulder in surrender, looking away.
Aye, go on then, he muttered,
and turned his back, stalwartly guarding the road along which new prisoners were still being herded. A quick traverse of the field turned up 3 buckets and a like number of sensible women, worried but not hysterical. I sent them to the stream and began to quarter the field, making a quick assessment of the situation, as much in order to keep my own worry at bay as because there was no one else to do it. Would we be kept here long, I wondered. If we would be held here for more than a few hours, sanitation trenches must be dug, but the soldiers would have the same need. I'd leave that for the army to deal with then. Water was coming. We'd need to run relays to the stream non-stop for a bit. Shelter. I glanced at the sky. It was hazy, but clear. Those who could move on their own were already helping to drag the desperately sick or wounded into the shade of the trees along one side of the field. Where was Jamie? Had he got away safe? Above the calls and anxious conversations, I heard now and then the whisper of distant thunder. The air clung to my skin, thick with humidity. They would have to move us somewhere, to the nearest settlement, wherever that might be. But it might take several days. I had no idea where we were. Had he been captured too? If so, would they take him to the same place they'd take the invalids? Chances were that they would release the women, not wishing to feed them. The women would stay with their sick men, though, or most of them would, sharing whatever food was available. I was walking slowly across the field, conducting a mental triage. The man on the stretcher there was going to die, probably before nightfall. I could hear the rails of his breathing from 6 feet away, when I caught sight of movement on the cabin's porch. The family, 2 adult women, 2 teenagers, 3 children, and a baby in arms, was leaving, clutching baskets, blankets, and such bits of their household as could be carried. One of the officers was with them. He took them across the field and spoke with one of the guards, evidently instructing him to let the women pass. One of the women paused at the edge of the road and looked back. Just once. The others went straight on without a backward glance. Where were their men? Where are mine? Hello, I said, smiling at a man with a recently amputated leg. I didn't know his name, but recognized his face. He was one of the few black men at Ticonderoga, a carpenter. I knelt down beside him. His bandages were awry and the stump was leaking badly. Father Leg, how do you feel? His skin was pale grey and clammy as a wet sheet, but he gave me a feeble grin in return. My left hand doesn't hurt much right now. He lifted it in illustration, but dropped it like a chunk of lead, lacking strength to hold it up. That's good, I said, sliding my fingers under his thigh to lift it. Let me fix this for you. We'll have you some water in a minute. That'd be nice, he murmured, and shut his eyes against the sun. The flapping end of the loose bandage was twisted up like a snake's tongue, stiff with dried blood, and the dressing awry. The dressing itself, a poultice of flaxseed and turpentine, was soggy, pink with leaking blood and lymph. No choice but to reuse it, though. What's your name?
Walter.
His eyes were still closed, his breath coming in shallow gasps. So was mine. The thick, hot air was like a pressure bandage round my chest.
Walter Woodcock.
Pleased to know you, Walter. My name's Claire Fraser.
Know you, he murmured. You're Big Red's lady. You make it out of the fort?
Yes, I said, and blotted my face against my shoulder to keep the sweat out of my eyes. He's all right. Dear God, let him be all right. The English officer was coming back toward the cabin, passing within a few feet of me. I glanced up and my hands froze. He was tall, slender, but broad-shouldered, and I would have known that long stride, that unself-conscious grace and that arrogant tilt of the head anywhere. He paused, frowning, and turned his head to survey the littered field. His nose was straight as a knife blade, just that tiny bit too long. I closed my eyes for an instant, dizzy, sure I was hallucinating, but opened them again at once, knowing that I wasn't. William Ransom? I blurted, and his head jerked toward me, surprised. Blue eyes, dark blue, Fraser cat eyes, narrowed to a slant against the sun.
I beg your pardon?
God, what did you speak to him for? But I couldn't have helped it. My fingers were pressed against Walter's leg, holding the bandage. I could feel his femoral pulse against my fingertips, bumping as erratically as my own.
Do I know you, ma'am?
William asked with a shadow of a bow. Well, yes, you do, I said, rather apologetically. You stayed for a little time with my family, some years ago, a place called Fraser's Ridge. His face changed at once at the name, and his gaze sharpened, focusing on me with interest.
Why, yes, he said slowly. I recall. You are Mrs. Fraser, are you not?
I could see his thoughts working and was fascinated. He hadn't got Jamie's way of hiding what he thought, or if he did, wasn't using it. I could see him wondering, nice, well-mannered boy that he was, what the proper social response to this awkward situation might be. And, a quick glance over his shoulder at the cabin, how the demands of his duty might conflict with it. His shoulders stiffened with decision, but before he could say anything, I leapt in. "Do you think it might be possible to find some buckets for water? And bandages?" Most of the women had already torn strips from their petticoats to serve this function much longer, and we'd all be half naked. "Yes," he said slowly, and glanced down at Walter, then toward the road. "Buckets, yes. There's a surgeon with the division behind us. When I have a moment, I'll send someone back with a request for bandages." "And food?" I asked hopefully. I hadn't eaten more than a handful of half-ripe berries in nearly 2 days. I wasn't suffering hunger pangs, my stomach was in knots, but I was having bouts of light-headedness, spots passing before my eyes. No one else was in much better case. We were going to lose a number of the invalids to the heat and simple weakness if we weren't given food and shelter soon. He hesitated, and I saw his eyes flit over the field, obviously estimating numbers. "That may be... our supply train is..." His lips firmed, and he shook his head. "I'll see what can be done. Your servant, ma'am." He bowed politely and turned away, striding toward the road. I watched him go, fascinated, the soggy dressing limp in my hand. He was dark-haired, though the sun struck a gleam of red from the crown of his head. He wore no powder. His voice had deepened. Well, of course it had. He'd been no more than 12 the last time I met him. And the sheer oddness of hearing Jamie speak in a cultured English accent made me want to laugh, despite our precarious situation and my worry for Jamie and Ian. I shook my head and returned to the task at hand. A British private arrived an hour after my conversation with Lieutenant Ransom, bearing 4 buckets, which he dropped unceremoniously at my side without a remark before heading back to the road. 2 hours later, a sweating orderly came trundling through the trampled wheat with 2 large haversacks filled with bandages. Interestingly enough, he headed directly for me, which made me wonder just how William had described me. "Thank you." I took the sacks of bandages with gratitude. Do you think we might get some food soon?" The orderly was looking over the field, grimacing. Of course, the invalids were likely about to become his responsibility. He turned back to me, though, civil but obviously very tired. "I doubt it, ma'am. The supply train is 2 days behind us, and the troops are living off what they're carrying or what they find as they go." He nodded toward the road. On the other side, I could see a number of English soldiers making camp. "I'm sorry," he added formally, and turned to go. "Oh." He stopped, and taking the strap of his canteen off, handed it to me. It was heavy and gurgled enticingly. "Lord Ellesmere said I was to give you this." He smiled briefly, the lines of tiredness easing. "He said you looked hot." "Lord Ellesmere?" That must be William's title, I realized. "Thank you. And please thank the lieutenant if you see him." He was clearly on the point of departure, but I couldn't help asking, "How did you know who I was?" His smile deepened as he glanced at my head. "The lieutenant said you'd be the curly wig giving orders like a sergeant major." He looked round the field once more, shaking his head. "Good luck, ma'am." 3 men died before sunset. Walter Woodcock was still alive, but barely. We'd moved as many men as we could into the shade of the trees along the edge of the field, and I divided the seriously wounded into small groups, each allocated a bucket and 2 or 3 women, or walking invalids, to tend them. I'd also designated a latrine area and done my best to separate the infectious cases from those who were fevered from wounds or malaria. There were 3 suffering from what I hoped was only summer ague, and 1 who I feared might have diphtheria. I sat beside him, a young wheelwright from New Jersey, checking the membranes of his throat at intervals, giving him as much water as he would take. Not from my canteen, though. William Ransom, bless his soul, had filled his canteen with brandy. I uncorked it and took a sparing sip. I'd poured out small cupfuls for each small group, adding each cupful to a bucket of water, but had kept a bit for my own use. It wasn't selfishness. For better or worse, I was in charge of the captives for the moment. I had to stay on my feet. Or my bottom, as the case might be, I thought, leaning back against the bole of an oak tree. My feet ached all the way to my knees. My back and ribs twinged with each breath, and I had to close my eyes now and then to control the dizziness. But I was sitting still for what seemed like the first time in several days. The soldiers across the road were cooking their meagre rations. My mouth watered and my stomach contracted painfully at the scent of roasting meat and flour. Mrs. Wellman's little boy was whining with hunger, his head laid on his mother's lap. She was stroking his hair mechanically, her eyes fixed on her husband's body, which lay a little way away. We had no sheet or blanket with which to shroud him, but someone had given her a handkerchief to cover his face. The flies were very bad. The air had cooled, thank God, but was still heavy with the threat of rain. Thunder was a constant faint rumble over the horizon, and it would probably pour sometime during the night. I plucked the sweat-soaked fabric away from my chest. I doubted it would have time to dry before we were drenched with rain. I eyed the encampment across the road with its lines of small tents and brush shelters with envy. There was a slightly larger officer's tent as well, though several officers had taken up temporary quarters in the commandeered cabin. I ought to go there, I thought, see the most senior officer present and beg for food for the children, at least. When the shadow of that tall pine sapling touched my foot, I decided, then I'd go. In the meantime, I uncorked the canteen and took another small swallow. Movement caught my eye and I looked up. The unmistakable figure of Lieutenant Ransom stalked out of the tents and came across the road. It lifted my heart a little to see him, though the sight of him renewed my worry for Jamie and reminded me, with a small, sharp pang, of Brianna. At least she was safe, I thought. Roger and Jemmy and Amanda, too. I repeated their names to myself as a small refrain of comfort, counting them like coins. Four of them safe. William had undone his stock, and his hair was untidy, his coat stained with sweat and dirt. Evidently the pursuit was wearing on the British Army, too. He glanced round the field, spotted me, and turned purposefully in my direction. I got my feet under me, struggling upward against the press of gravity like a hippopotamus rising from a swamp. I'd barely got to my feet and raised a hand to smooth my hair when someone else's hand poked me in the back. I started violently, but luckily didn't scream. "It's me, Auntie," young Ian whispered from the shadows behind me. "Come with—" "Oh, Jesus!" William had come within 10 paces of me, and raising his head had spied Ian. He leapt forward and grabbed me by the arm, yanking me away from the trees. I yelped as Ian had an equally firm grip on the other arm and was yanking lustily in that direction.
"Let her go," William barked. "The devil I will," Ian replied hotly. "You let go."
Mrs. Wellman's little son was on his feet, staring round-eyed and open-mouthed into the forest.
"Mama! Mama! Indians!"
Shrieks rose from the women near us and everyone began a mad scramble away from the forest, leaving the wounded to their own devices.
"Ah, bugger," Ian said, letting go in disgust.
William didn't, jerking me with such force that I crashed into him, whereupon he promptly wrapped his arms about my waist and dragged me a little way into the field.
"Will you bloody leave go of my auntie?" Ian said crossly, emerging from the trees.
"You," William said. "What are you—"
"Well, never mind that. Your aunt, you say?"
He looked down at me.
"Are you
his aunt?"
"Wait. No, of course you are."
"I am," I agreed, pushing at his arms. "Let go!"
His grasp loosened a little, but he didn't release me.
"How many others are in there?" he demanded, lifting his chin toward the forest.
"If there were any others, you'd be dead,"
Ian informed him.
"It's just me.
Give her to me."
"I can't do that."
But there was an uncertain note in William's voice, and I felt his head turn, glancing toward the cabin. So far, no one had come out, but I could see some of the sentries near the road shifting to and fro, wondering what the matter was. The other captives had stopped running, but were quivering with incipient panic, eyes frantically searching the shadows among the trees. I rapped William sharply on the wrist with my knuckles, and he let go and took a step back. My head was spinning again, not least from the very peculiar sensation of being embraced by a total stranger whose body felt so familiar to me. He was thinner than Jamie, but...
"Do you owe me a life or not?"
Not waiting for an answer, Ian jerked a thumb at me.
"Aye, then. It's hers."
"Hardly a question of her life," William said rather crossly, with an awkward nod in my direction, acknowledging that I might have a possible interest in this discussion.
"Surely you don't suppose we kill women?"
"No," Ian said evenly. "I dinna suppose it at all. I ken very well that you do."
"We do?" William echoed.
He looked surprised, but a sudden flush burned in his cheeks.
"You do," I assured him. "General Howe hanged three women at the head of his army in New Jersey, as an example."
He seemed completely nonplussed by this.
"Well, but they were spies."
"You think I don't look like a spy?" I inquired. "I'm much obliged for your good opinion. But I don't know that General Burgoyne would share it."
There were, of course, a good many other women who died at the hands of the British Army, if less officially, but this didn't seem the moment to make an account of them.
"General Burgoyne is a gentleman," William said stiffly. "So am I."
"Good," Ian said briefly. "Turn your back for 30 seconds and we'll trouble you nae more."
I don't know whether he would have done it or not, but just then Indian cries tore the air, coming from the far side of the road. Further frantic screams came from the captives, and I bit my own tongue in order not to scream too. A tongue of fire shot up into the lavender sky from the top of the officer's tent. As I gaped, two more flaming comets shot across the sky. It looked like the descent of the Holy Ghost, but before I could mention this interesting observation, Ian had seized my arm and jerked me nearly off my feet. I managed to snatch up the canteen as we passed, on a dead run for the forest. Ian grabbed it from me, almost dragging me in his haste. Gunfire and screams were breaking out behind us, and the skin all down my back contracted in fear.
"This way."
I followed him without heed for anything underfoot, stumbling and twisting my ankles in the dusk as we threw ourselves headlong into the brush, expecting every moment to be shot in the back. Such is the brain's capacity for self-amusement. I was able to imagine in vivid detail my wounding, capture, descent into infection and sepsis, and eventual lingering death, but not before being obliged to witness the capture and execution of both Jamie... I had recognized the source of the Indian screams and flaming arrows without difficulty, and Ian. It was only as we slowed, perforce. I had such a stitch in my side that I could barely breathe, but I thought of other things. The sick and wounded I had left behind, the young wheelwright with a bright red throat, Walter Woodcock teetering over the abyss. "You couldn't give any of them more than a hand to hold," I told myself fiercely, limping as I stumbled after Ian. It was true. I knew it was true. But I also knew that now and then a hand in the dark gave a sick man something to cling to against the rushing wind of the dark angel. Sometimes it was enough. Sometimes it wasn't. But the ache of those left behind dragged at me like a sea anchor, and I wasn't sure whether the wetness streaming down my cheeks was sweat or tears. It was full dark now, and the boiling clouds covered the moon, allowing only fitful glimpses of its brilliant light. Ian had slowed still more to let me keep up with him, and took my arm now and then to help me over rocks or across creeks.
"How far?" I gasped, stopping once more for breath.
"Not much," Jamie's voice replied softly beside me. "Are you all right, Sassenach?"
My heart gave a tremendous bump, then settled back in my chest as he groped for my hand, then gathered me briefly against himself. I had a moment of relief so profound that I thought my bones had dissolved.
"Yes," I said into his chest,
and with great effort lifted my head.
"You? Well enough now,"
he said, passing a hand over my head, touching my cheek.
"Can you walk just a bit further?"
I straightened, swaying a little. It had begun to rain. Heavy drops plopped into my hair, cold and startling on my scalp.
"Ian, have you got that canteen?"
There was a soft pop, and Ian set the canteen in my hand. Very carefully, I tilted it into my mouth.
"Is that brandy?" Jamie said, sounding astonished.
"Mm-hmm." I swallowed as slowly as I could and handed the canteen to him. There were a couple of swallows left.
"Where did you get it?"
"Your son gave it to me," I said. "Where are we going?" There was a long pause from the darkness, and then the sound of brandy being drunk.
"South," he said at last,
and, taking my hand, led me on into the wood, the rain whispering on the leaves all round us. Soaked and shivering, we caught up to a militia unit just before dawn and were nearly shot in mistake by a nervous sentry. By that point, I didn't really care. Being dead was immensely preferable to the prospect of taking one more step. Our bona fides being established, Jamie disappeared briefly and came back with a blanket and three fresh corn dodgers. I inhaled my share of this ambrosia in 4 seconds flat, wrapped myself in the blanket, and lay down under a tree where the ground was damp but not soggy, and so thick with dead leaves that it gave spongily beneath me.
"I'll be back in a bit, Sassenach," Jamie whispered, squatting beside me. "Dinna go anywhere, I."
"Don't worry. I'll be here. If I move a muscle before Christmas, it will be too soon." A faint warmth was already returning to my shivering muscles, and sleep was pulling me down with the inexorability of quicksand. He gave the breath of a laugh and reached out a hand, tucking the blanket in around my shoulders. The dawn light showed the deep lines that the night had carved in his face, the smudges of dirt and exhaustion that stained the strong bones. The wide mouth, compressed for so long, had relaxed now in the relief of momentary safety, looking oddly young and vulnerable.
"He looks like you," I whispered.
His hand stopped moving, still on my shoulder, and he looked down, long lashes hiding his eyes.
"I know," he said very softly. "Tell me of him, later, when there's time."
I heard his footsteps, a rustle in damp leaves, and fell asleep, a prayer for Walter Woodcock half finished in my mind. Chapter 57. The Deserter Game. The whore grunted through the rag clenched in her teeth. "Nearly done," I murmured, and ran the backs of my knuckles gently down her calf by way of reassurance before returning to the debridement of the nasty wound in her foot. An officer's horse had stepped on her as they, and a number of other people and animals, had jostled to drink at a creek during the retreat. I could clearly see the print of the horseshoe nails black in the red puffy flesh of her instep. The edge of the shoe itself, worn paper thin and sharp as a knife, had made a deep curved gash that ran across the metatarsals, vanishing between the fourth and fifth toes. I'd been afraid I was going to have to remove the little toe. It seemed to be dangling by no more than a shred of skin. But when I examined the foot more closely, I discovered that all the bones were miraculously intact, as nearly as I could tell, without access to an X-ray machine. The horse's hoof had driven her foot into the mud of the stream bank, she told me. That had likely saved the bones from being crushed. Now, if I could manage to stem the infection and didn't have to amputate the foot, she might just be able to walk again normally. Maybe. With a degree of cautious hope, I put down the scalpel and reached for a bottle of what I hoped was a penicillin-containing liquid brought with me from the fort. I'd salvaged the barrel optic of Dr. Rawling's microscope from the house fire and found it very useful indeed for starting fires, but without the eyepiece, staging mechanism, or mirror, it was of limited use in determining the genus of microorganisms. I could be sure that what I'd grown and filtered was bread mould, all right, but beyond that. Suppressing a sigh, I poured the liquid generously over the raw flesh I'd just exposed. It wasn't alcoholic, but the flesh was raw. The whore made a high-pitched noise through the cloth and breathed through her nose like a steam engine, but by the time I'd made a compress of lavender and comfrey and bound up the foot, she was calm, if flushed. "There," I said, with a small pat to her leg. "I think that will do nicely now." I started to say automatically, "Keep it clean," but bit my tongue. She hadn't any shoes or stockings, and was either walking daily through a wilderness of rocks, dirt, and streams, or living in a filthy camp littered with piles of dung, both human and animal. The bottoms of her feet were hard as horn and black as sin. "Come and find me in a day or two," I said instead. "If you can," I thought. "I'll check it and change the dressing." "If I can," I thought, with a glance at the knapsack in the corner where I kept my dwindling stocks of medicaments. "Thank ye kindly," the horse said, sitting up and putting her foot gingerly to the ground. Judging from the skin of her legs and feet, she was young, though you couldn't tell from her face. Her skin was weathered, lined with hunger and strain. Her cheekbones were sharp with hunger, and her mouth was drawn in on one side where the teeth were missing, lost to decay, or knocked out by a customer or another whore. "Will he be here for a bit, think?" she asked. "I've a friend, like. Got the itch." "I'll be here for the night, at least," I assured her, suppressing a groan as I rose to my feet. "Send your friend. I'll see what I can do." Our group of militia had met with others, forming a large body, and within a few days we began to cross paths with other rebel groups. We were running into fragments of General Schuyler and General Arnold's armies, these also moving south down the Hudson Valley. We were still moving all day, but began to feel secure enough to sleep at night, and with food provided, irregularly but still food, by the army, my strength began to return. The rain usually came at night, but today it had been raining at dawn, and we had been trudging through mud for hours before some shelter came in sight. General Arnold's troops had stripped the farmstead and burnt the house. The barn was heavily charred down one side, but the fire had gone out before consuming the building. A gust of wind blew through the barn, raising eddies of decayed straw and dirt, whipping our petticoats round our legs. The barn had originally had a plank floor. I could see the lines of the boards embedded in the dirt. The foragers had taken them for firewood, but it had been too much trouble for them to knock down the barn, thank God. Some of the refugees fleeing Ticonderoga had sought shelter here. More would be along before nightfall. A mother with two small, exhausted children slept, curled by the far wall. Her husband had settled them there and gone to look for food. "Pray ye that your flight be not in the winter, nor on the Sabbath day." I followed the whore to the door and stood looking after her. The sun was touching the horizon now, perhaps an hour of light left, But the sunset breeze was already moving in the treetops, Knight's skirts rustling as she came. I shivered reflexively, though the day was still warm enough. The old barn was chilly, and the nights were beginning to bite. Any day we would wake to frost on the ground. "And what then?" said the small, apprehensive voice that lived in the pit of my stomach. "Then I'll put on another pair of stockings," I muttered to it. "Hush up!" A truly Christian person would doubtless have given the spare stockings to the barefoot whore, remarked the sanctimonious voice of my conscience. "You hush up, too," I said. "Plenty of opportunity to be Christian later, if the urge should strike me." Half the people fleeing needed stockings, I dared say. I wondered what I might be able to do for the whore's friend if she did come. The itch might be anything from eczema or cowpox to gonorrhea, though, given the woman's profession, something venereal was the best bet. Back in Boston, it would likely have been a simple yeast infection. Oddly enough, I almost never saw those here, and speculated idly that it might be owing to the nearly universal lack of underclothes. So much for the advances of modernity. I glanced at my knapsack again, calculating what I had left and how I might use it. A fair amount of bandages and lint, a pot of gentian ointment, good for scrapes and minor wounds, which occurred in abundance, a small stock of the most useful herbs for tincture and compress, lavender, comfrey, peppermint, mustard seed. By some miracle, I still had the bottle of cinchona bark I had acquired in New Bern. I thought of Tom Christie and crossed myself, but dismissed him from mind. There was nothing I could do about him, and much too much to think of here. Two scalpels I had taken from Lieutenant Stacktoe's body, he had succumbed to a fever on the road, and my silver surgical scissors. Jamie's gold acupuncture needles, those might be used to treat others, say that I had no idea how to place them for anything other than seasickness. I could hear voices. Parties of foragers moving through the trees, here and there someone calling out a name, searching for a friend or family member lost in transit. The refugees were beginning to settle for the night. Sticks cracked near at hand, and a man came out of the woods. I didn't recognize him. One of the greasy stocking knaves from one of the militias, no doubt. He had a musket in one hand and a powder horn at his belt. Not much else. And yes, he was barefoot, though his feet were much too big to wear my stockings, a fact that I pointed out to my conscience, in case it should feel compelled to try to prod me into charitable behaviour again. He saw me in the door and raised a hand. "You the conjure woman?" he called. "Yes." I'd given up trying to make people call me a doctor, let alone a physician. "Met a whore with a mighty fine new bandage on her foot," the man said, giving me a smile. "She said as there's a conjure woman up to the barn has some medicines." "Yes," I said again, giving him a quick once-over. I saw no obvious wound, and he wasn't sick. I could tell that from his colour and the upright way he walked. Perhaps he had a wife or child, or a sick comrade. "Hand him over to me, now," he said, still smiling, and pointed the muzzle of the musket at me. "What?" I said, surprised. "Give me the medicines you've got." He made a small jabbing motion with the gun. "Could just shoot you and take 'em, but I ain't wanting to waste the powder." I stood still and stared at him for a moment. "What the devil do you want them for?" I'd been held up once before for drugs, in a Boston emergency room. A young addict, sweating and glassy-eyed, with a gun. I'd handed them over instantly. At the moment, I wasn't inclined. He snorted and cocked his gun. Before I could even think about being scared, there was a sharp bang and the scent of powder smoke. The man looked terribly surprised, the musket sagging in his hands. Then he fell at my feet.
"Hold that, Sassenach."
Jamie thrust the just-fired pistol into my hand, stooped, and took the body by the feet. He dragged it out of the barn into the rain. I swallowed, reached into my bag, and took out the extra stockings. I dropped these in the woman's lap, then went to set down the pistol and my sack by the wall. I was conscious of the eyes of the mother and her children on me, and saw them shift suddenly to the open door. I turned to see Jamie come in, soaked to the skin, his face drawn and set with fatigue. He crossed the barn and sat down by me, laying his head on his knees and closed his eyes.
"Thank you, sir," said the woman very softly. "Ma'am."
I thought for a moment he had fallen instantly asleep, for he didn't stir. After a moment, though, he said in an equally soft voice,
"You're welcome, ma'am."
I was more than pleased to find the hunters when we reached the next village. They had been in one of the barges that had been captured early, but had succeeded in escaping by the simple expedient of walking into the woods after dark. As the soldiers who had captured them hadn't bothered to count their captives, no one noticed they had gone. Overall, things were looking up somewhat. Food was becoming more abundant, and we were among regular Continentals. We were still only a few miles in front of Burgoyne's army, though, and the strain of the long retreat was telling. Desertion was frequent, though no one knew quite how frequent. Organisation, discipline, and military structure were being restored as we came under the sway of the Continental Army, but there were still men who could melt away unobtrusively. It was Jamie who thought of the deserter game. Deserters would be welcomed into the British camps, fed, given clothes, and interrogated for information.
"So we'll give it to them, aye?" he said. "And it's only fair we take the same in return, is it not?"
Smiles began to grow on the faces of the officers to whom he was propounding this idea. And within a few days, carefully chosen deserters were making their way surreptitiously to the enemy camps and being taken before British officers, where they poured out the stories with which they'd been carefully prepared. And after a good supper, they would take the first opportunity to re-desert back to the American side, bringing with them useful information about the British forces pursuing us. Ian dropped into Indian camps now and then if it seemed safe, but didn't play this particular game. He was memorable. I thought Jamie would have liked to masquerade as a deserter. It would appeal to his sense of drama as well as his sense of adventure, which was acute. His size and striking appearance put this notion out of consideration, though. The deserters must all be ordinary-looking men who were unlikely to be recognised later.
"Because sooner or later the British are going to realise what's afoot. They're not fools, and they will not take it kindly when they do realise."
We had found shelter for the night in another barn, this one unburnt and still equipped with a few piles of musty hay, though the stock had long since vanished. We were alone, but probably wouldn't be for long. The interlude in the commandant's garden seemed as though it had taken place in someone else's life, but I laid my head on Jamie's shoulder, relaxing against his solid warmth.
"Do you think maybe..."
Jamie stopped abruptly, his hand tightening on my leg. An instant later, I heard the stealthy rustling that had alerted him, and my mouth went dry. It might be anything from a prowling wolf to an Indian ambush, but whatever it was sizable, and I fumbled, as silently as possible, for the pocket in which I'd stowed the knife he'd given me. Not a wolf. Something passed the open door, a shadow the height of a man, and vanished. Jamie squeezed my thigh, and then was gone, moving, crouched through the empty barn without a sound. For an instant I couldn't see him in the dark, but my eyes were well adapted, and I found him seconds later, a long, dark shadow pressed against the wall just inside the door. The shadow outside had come back. I saw the brief silhouette of a head against the paler black of the night outside. I got my feet under me, skin prickling with fear. The door was the only egress. Perhaps I should throw myself on the floor and roll up against the base of a wall. I might escape detection, or with luck, be able to grab the ankles of an intruder or stab him through the foot. I was just about to implement this strategy when a tremulous whisper came out of the dark.
Friend James, it said,
and I let out the